The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2013 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2013. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the internet. To find out more about ACCS, or to order additional conference talks, visit our website at accsedu.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome. This is on classroom management. The speakers will introduce themselves in a moment. The cards, if you have some, are for asking them questions about classroom management. And as you fill them out, if you'll just hold them up, and I'll try to come by and get them. And we've got plenty of cards here. If you fill them all out, we won't get out of here today, but that's all right. That's the purpose. So I don't want to, just want to be sure you're in the right room and you've got some cards. And okay, thanks. So I will, I'm Don Post, the headmaster at Tall Oaks Classical School in Newcastle, Delaware. This is, they'll introduce themselves and we'll get started.
Hello, I'm Barbara Seifer. I teach first grade at Tall Oaks Classical School in Newcastle, Delaware.
And I'm Dori Zinkind, and I'm the principal of Tall Oaks. And Barbara replaced me. I used to teach first grade. I used to teach second grade. So, the topic is classroom management. What we're going to do is to give you a few thoughts to start out. And then we'll depend on you for some questions to keep us going here. I'm going to kind of talk about the principles and definitions, set some groundwork, and Barbara's right in the classroom right now, so she's going to be able to give you more practical what it actually looks like and give you some examples of some ways that she does things to kind of get our discussion going. So first, what is classroom management? There are a lot of things that go into managing the classroom. That includes lesson planning, discipline, management of supplies, etc. We're going to focus here today is the management and flow of classroom activity. The discipline piece is being so well covered by Matt Whitling's workshops that we don't need to spend a lot of time on that. We're going to focus on managing your time and supplies and transitions. In short, good stewardship of your time and materials. Barbara and I will each talk for a few minutes here, and then our moderator, Mr. Post, will collect up your questions. Okay. Planning how you're going to manage your day and training your students in those procedures will reap huge benefits for you, and I want to talk first about what some of those benefits are. First, the most precious resource you have in that classroom is your time. You are only given so much of it, and once it's spent, it's gone. So good planning and practice will save you a lot of time, and you'll have more time for teaching and less time for shuffling. Okay. Children enjoy knowing what to expect and knowing what they are to do. It helps them to focus, and it helps them to become more independent. With good planning, you'll be relieved of 100 frustrations a day. When a student can't find a sharpened pencil, when you have to stop a lesson to explain a procedure, when the students aren't all ready to begin and you have to re-explain what you already explained once, when you have to break up squabbles over how they're lining up, you lose 5 minutes collecting up everyone's papers. In short, with good planning, you'll be less grumpy. You will also spend less time chiding, instructing, and correcting, so your students will be less grumpy. Okay. More of your lessons will get covered with the time you save, and your school will save money because of your better stewardship of supplies. Your classroom will be cleaner and healthier, and you'll be able to keep the classroom in an orderly and neat way. So some general principles to keep in mind as you're doing your planning for how you're going to manage your classroom. One, you need to create an environment that respects the needs of everyone, the teacher and the students. Just like courtesy in general, the procedures you set up for your classroom should communicate this respect for everyone. And for young children, this includes things like the need to change activities after a short while. They can't go 30 minutes doing one thing. The need to move around, the need to do things rather than just sit and listen. Second, you need to organize your room so that materials are kept close to where they're going to be used and so that students in the age of that classroom can reach what they need without help. I once was in a classroom observing. The room was set up so that all the chairs kind of backed up against the back wall, so the only way to cross the classroom was to do so in the front of the classroom. And I was observing in winter, sniffly nose season, and the tissue box was on the teacher's desk on the right side of the classroom. So any student who needed to get up and get a tissue, and there were several because it was January, February, had to go forward, walk across the front of the classroom, and go to the tissue box. Then the trash can was on the other side of the so they had to cross in the front of the classroom again, perhaps in front of the teacher, to go throw the tissue away, and then maybe a third time, depending on where their chair was, to come again and sit down and return to their seat. Little things like that need to be thought through. Tissue box needs to be next to the trash can. You need to be able to cross the classroom without crossing in front of the teacher or near the teacher so that other students are distracted. Those kinds of things. You need to develop procedures that use the least amount of time and save labor. Now, that seems obvious, like I shouldn't have to tell you that, but I have seen situations where the primary focus was that everybody have a chore. And so we organize our classrooms so that everybody has a chore. And in order to give 17 people or 20 people a chore, you've got the most inefficient system there is. One person empties the trash, the other one puts the bag in. One, two, you know, these all separate things, less efficient. So let people take turns and organize it so that it's most efficient. Students need to know what they are to be doing, and that requires an investment in training. This is especially important for kids with attention and distractibility issues. An established routine eliminates the need for them to decide what to do next. As they're trained in it, they can automatically do it. They know where to be, where they are to be, and what they are to be doing. So as much training time you put in will pay dividends. The procedures that you introduce should also foster independence as much as possible for the grade level that you're working with. You're giving them the tools for efficient independence. So by teaching them a routine which they can use then independently, they have some experience at being independent and they can grow with that. Another thing is to make sure that you have everyone's attention before giving instructions or starting a lesson. In the classroom observations I do, I think the number one thing that we write up teachers for on their observation forms is that they failed to get every student's attention before they started giving instructions. This means a good 20% of them didn't hear the instructions the first time. It has to be repeated, or they have to be corrected for not doing what you told them to do. That's very, very important. Now, every procedure that you do every day ought to be analyzed and made simpler and smoother. This is a great thing to do at the beginning of the year to kind of walk through your day. How are you going to be sure everyone has a sharp pencil? How are you going to line up for lunch? How will you hand out and collect your papers? How will you manage emptying and packing up backpacks? What will students keep in their desks? And perhaps more important, what will they not keep in their desks? What about water bottles? How are you going to handle that? How does the trash get emptied? Get these things worked out ahead of time, so that you're not responding to problems and making decisions during the course of the day. And then as you go through your days, self-evaluate. How did it go? What could I do better? This is something that you perfect in, over time. And one other suggestion I would have before after you've gotten some procedures in place, is to have someone else watch and give you feedback. That could be an administrator, it could be another teacher. But I had the privilege 1 year of working with another teacher. I was principal half time and teaching half time. She was teaching half time. And we would sit in the back for each other and watch. And it's amazing how much someone else can pick up that you don't pick up yourself. You know, you may not see the kids passing notes in the back row, but the teacher observing from the back does. But all sorts of inefficiencies and all those kind of things might be something that someone else could pick up that you're not seeing and give you some good ideas for. So I'm going to turn over to Barbara now, and she's going to get more practical.
Never know quite how close this needs to be to me. Hopefully you can hear me. As I begin to think about classroom management as a classroom teacher, I am reminded of a quote by G.K. Chesterton, which relates to Christianity, but I think it also really relates to Christian education, the settings, and the importance of order. And the quote is, "And the more I consider Christianity, the more I found that while it had established a rule and order, the chief aim of that order was to give room for good things to run wild." Lord willing, the chief end of classroom management and classroom order is to give room for good things to run wild in our classroom. Good things like learning, certainly. Good things like love and joy, peace and patience and kindness and goodness and self-control. The experiences that I will share are those of my classroom, books I've read on the subject, classrooms of colleagues that have shared their knowledge and experience with me. Certainly, and I truly mean this, certainly these things are not the only way that classrooms function best. But hopefully it will encourage you to find a style and a process for your classroom that works best for you and for your students. The first area that I want to talk about was just some strategies of classroom management. Benjamin Franklin once said that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Now, although I am certainly confident that he did not teach early primary grades at a classical Christian school, I believe his words touch upon something very important for us here today. If we plan well, if we take that time up front and look at the processes and look in the patterns of our classroom, we, that includes both our students and ourselves, will reap the benefits in our classroom. A well-ordered classroom creates the best possible learning environment. The times in my school year, and there have been more than a few, where I have found myself at the end of the day exhausted and frustrated, are typically the days, looking back, that I have found they were least managed. You know that kind of day, or perhaps you don't. I hope you don't, but perhaps you do, where I get in my car on the ride home, and I have two children in Tall Oaks, and they'll try to talk to me, and I'll be like, no, I've had 20 people saying, Mrs. Seifer, all day long, or I'll get home, and I'll walk into my room, and we have a code in my home, and that is, I'm going in my room too clean, which means I'm going to fall across my bed, pillow is going to land, my face is going to land on the pillow, and I'll fall into a nap for no short amount of time. Those are the days that were least managed for me, where too many unexpected things happened, and I wasn't quite sure how to handle them, and I didn't really think through all of the things that I should have. If it were possible for me to turn back the clock and redo those days, what I would change is the most proper expectation setting for the children and managing that flurry of activity better. Better managing my teaching space makes me a better teacher and able to teach those students well. The main areas that I want to cover today in classroom management are classroom processes, paper and supply flow, classroom layout, and some strategies for improvement. Before I start the school year each year, I try to sit down and think through my school day. This usually happens around teacher training a week or two beforehand, especially that first few days of the school year. And it is easy for me to scope out the big areas. When I'll teach math, when I'll teach spelling, reading, when the children have PE, the timing of lunch and recess. The harder part can really be thinking through all the little steps, all the processes, all the little things that I need to remember that need to get done. However, those little processes, when they're well thought out, everyone,
me included, is more at ease. I cannot and I will not expect the children in my classroom to make wise decisions if I haven't communicated what I've expected of them. First area is classroom processes, is lining up. Seems like the students just get into my classroom on that very first day, and the first thing I want to teach them is how to leave the classroom. Can seem kind of ironic, huh? But the most important process that needs to be done, nonetheless. Think about how you want your students to line up, at what queuing, and how they should line up. In my classroom and all the grammar school classrooms at Tall Oaks, we line children up, girls first, and then the boys. And that being said, at the beginning of the line is the student of the day. We'll have additional tasks that we'll talk about later. I spend a lot of time that first week of school having children learn this process. And I do mean a lot of time, but it's time well spent. We practice this at a regular activity for bathroom breaks, heading to specials, etc., and also as a sudden and immediate task for security reasons, for fire drills or whatever kind of emergency we might encounter. Children should be able to go directly to line, silently, and be ready for the next task or instruction. And if they're unable, either individually or as a group, to complete this task, we practice it even more. It takes up time those first few days, but it is definitely time well spent. Along the same lines, we discuss practice moving through the halls, where our hands should be, how we should be acting, how we hold the door for one another. And we practice them some more. But the good news is, they want to do it well. They want to please their teacher. And what a blessing it is to have obedient and well-behaved class moving through our halls. It's a spiritual lesson in a way. We worship a God of order. And for my children and the children of the classes to be moving through our hall in an orderly fashion, they're able to make wise decisions and do things well. And they know it. And they know that they should be in order. And it's a blessing to our school as well. It's like in your schools, we have visitors coming through all the time. And it never fails that someone will come up to me and say, oh, what a sweet and kind and obedient class when they're holding the door and passing through the halls. That little step that makes a huge impact. Another thing that I teach early on is learning processes. I call attention position. In my classroom, there's several learning stations or areas. For example, math meeting, desk areas, reading areas. When the children are in desk areas and ready to engage in the lesson, they're taught and they practice attention position. I wish I could show it to you. They gave us a table that has a curtain. But long story short, my feet are flat on the floor. I should be sitting with my back to the back of the chair. My hands are on top of my desk, and they are folded just like this, and I should be looking at my instructor. I'll look at Mr. Post. That's attention position. And my job as a first grade teacher, especially in that first week or so, is to teach them attention position. And when I use those words, when they're at the desk setting in a learning mode, I'll say attention position, and they get here. Not here. Not here. Here. And it almost becomes a game or a task that they want to get there as fast as they can. And if they break from attention position, I'll kind of look at them and they'll wait and they'll know, without trying to break attention position, who's not doing the right thing. And then we can move back into the lesson. At the beginning, it takes a little practice. By the end, especially in lessons like spelling and math, they're able to get there and stay there. And when I give them instructions, I can't guarantee that they hear every word I say or learning all the instructions, but I know that I have their attention. And hopefully, they're learning something bigger than the lesson at hand. They're learning how to be ready to learn. Similarly, children in math meeting, which is a carpeted area, have a certain style that they need to sit in as well, that infamous crisscross applesauce, and they have behavioral expectations. Typically, we sit on the perimeter of the carpet, and they need to have their hands in their lap. Once they know what to expect, they're much more able to attend to the task at hand. Now, I'm not certainly trying to tell you how you should instruct your students as to what behaviors they need. It's just that those things, when they're well thought out and communicated to the students, they're able to step up to the plate and be able to do their very best. Next one is an interesting one for teachers, and I know you've all been there. It's that issue in classroom management of hygiene and personal care processes. You know what I mean. Tissues, bathrooms, nurse visits, cough drops. The list goes on and on and on. Be thinking ahead of time, ahead of the school year, how you want to handle those processes. In Tall Oaks, we take bathroom breaks as a class early in the day, once before lunch, after recess, and 1 hour before the end of the school day. I know it sounds like we're there a lot. It's a training process, though, for these small children, and sometimes it takes longer to train others. But for me in my classroom, anytime one or more children are missing with an intermittent bathroom break, it's harder to stay on task and to the subject of the lesson. Similarly, I found, unless that it's an emergency, nurse visits for coughs, sore throats, boo-boos, a cut I had last week, getting tissues, etc., is best saved for transition times. And that's my next subject area, transition times. That's when children are moving from one subject area to another, typically requiring walking to an area, sometimes lining up to change classrooms. Occasionally it's staggered, where children finish classwork quicker than others and need to fill in remaining time with reading at their desk or another meaningful activity. And sometimes, for me it's most of the time, is a process that happens for the entire class at one time. Transitions can be a time when children move from one area to another that is a time that unfortunately can be wasted. Practice having your children move from one area to another, making special note if they need any supplies. This past year, my principal, who happens to be sitting next to me, instructed the teachers to go and visit other classrooms, teachers above them and teachers teaching a grade level below them, to kind of get some ideas, to see what's expected of students and to see what you should expect from the incoming students. And one thing I saw that I want to bring into my classroom this coming year is what's happening in kindergarten with the students. The kindergarten teacher at my school had them singing and chanting during transition times. So they were in math meeting, they're standing up, now they've got to go to their desk, let's sing a hymn, or at least a verse of a hymn, or let's practice that chant. And she said it was great because it helped them to do reviews. She got her reviewing in, but it also kept them from having this be an excellent time to tell Jimmy a joke they heard at lunch yesterday. And it really made good use of the time. Transitions, when they're well managed, can be a good use in our classroom. In my classroom, those in the lower primary grades at Tall Oaks move into a new classroom areas with a ladies first rule. It might be the same at your school or it might be different. That said, girls are reminded that it is a gift given by the boys and they should not make them wait by moving slowly or taking up extra time. These are just some ideas of how we handle transition. No matter how you handle transitions, make sure you establish behavioral goals and practice, practice, practice. Another area, important area in your class week is assessment protocol. Assessments are a part of the learning process and creating an environment that's easy to manage, quick to create, and of course this might include moving desks and chairs, and easy to put back into a regular classroom order can be very important. In my class, we remove desks from rows and pair desks facing each other, and then they put up offices that keep their vision blocked from the student in front of them. For assessments, and only for assessments, I hand out papers, but the student of the day helped or their helper can collect all the work after it's been completed. And part of this process is to always remind the students why they're moving their desks in the first place, to help them keep their eyes in a wise place and do their very best as unto Christ. Next area I want to talk about briefly is paper and supply flow. Turning in homework. This was something that I had to learn through the School of Hard Knocks in the first couple years that I taught. I tried a number of different ways, and usually I try to remember homework and I ask them to turn it in as I was starting to teach that same lesson. If it was a math lesson, I would be reminded that I needed to get those in. But I learned that I needed to establish a process and a timing for children to return homework each day. Preferably, this should not be something prompted. The more you remind your students to turn in homework, the more you will need to remind your students that they need to turn in their homework, and they will count on being reminded. It should be something that they do automatically each morning upon arrival. For my classroom, we have separate bins for math homework, the two different types, reading homework, penmanship homework, and then we also have a separate bin for office type items, paperwork that needs to go, like hot lunch forms, etc. Similarly, there's classwork that needs to go out, and you should establish a process for that as well. It can be any plan, certainly, that works for you, as long as it's thought out and communicated to the students and consistently followed. In my classroom, we use the student of the day and the student of the day's chosen assistant to complete this task, and they love having that responsibility of doing the job. Dory mentioned something near and dear to my heart. Along that same line is that pencil sharpening and desk supply management. Similar to classwork distribution and collection, you should establish a process for pencil sharpening, desk supply management, and it can be a plan that works for you as long as it's thought out and communicated and consistently followed. In the classroom, pencils are only sharpened, believe it or not, in the morning, or when homework is being put in bins and coats and backpacks are being hung up, and once in the afternoon. Then children learn that they need to sharpen several, or they need to borrow them from their friends in case one gets lost or broken. In general, the students in my class keep their supplies, erasers, glue sticks, and scissors in their desks, and are told at the beginning of a lesson what they need to get out. Then they need to listen to those instructions, because once I've given them, and they get them out or not, they need to live with that decision that they made. They're not going back in during an actual lesson happening. The last area that I want to talk about is an area of strategies for improvement. One thing that I've just said over and over, so I don't need to belabor it too much, is just mentally walking through your day all the time. And the other is when I made reference to watching other teachers. That process that we have of looking at teachers that teach the grade level above you and the grade level below you to get some ideas of how they handle similar processes. Anticipate, expect the unexpected. In early primary grades, things can change rapidly in the course of the day, and the more you can expect the unexpected, the better off you'll be. Talk to the other teachers on your floor and arrange coverage plans in case of emergencies. And another thing that I picked up from a teacher not too long ago is to print a list of the names of your students and put it on the back of your ID card. Never know when that fire drill or emergency happens and you've got the names of all of your students and their parents' cell numbers on the back. Can be invaluable in case of a real emergency. And then last but not least is periodic evaluations and adjusting accordingly. As you get through the end of that first day back to school and that first week and that first month, deciding what worked well and what didn't, and going back and continue to change and evolve can be a big lifesaver.
We have a question.
Thank you. He's getting him on cards. We switched the order we got them in. This is a word toward classroom management in a multi-level classroom. For example, first and second grade combined. A few hints for success. The reason she handed that to me is because I've actually done that. I did combined first and second. It is a challenge. so I'm going back a few years. One of the inevitable things that falls out of that is that there are times when you're instructing part of the class and not the other part of the class. That's probably the biggest problem. I approach that in several ways. Sometimes you can use parent volunteers to help for part of your day. That works well sometimes and sometimes not, depending on how good your volunteer is. The most successful thing, I think, for me was to think through independent activities that were useful and purposeful that the kids could do. I had classroom centers around the room. There were a number of activities that were actually required of them. They would have a worksheet, they would, you know, a list for the week that they would check off that they've done this station and that station as they went through the week. These were things that were purposeful. They were not time-wasting things. Very often they were review of material that they had already learned, and they were able to do their review time during that downtime that they had. Let me think, what else? Another thing is to combine as much as you can. Often what's covered in first grade and what's covered in second is similar. The second goes a little further or is held to another standard, but there's no reason why the first graders can't be in on it. You may not assess them the same, but you can teach them the same or have them part of a class or part of a discussion. So that's another option for that.
First question I have, it says, I believe in first time obedience, but I struggle with knowing what when it should apply to kindergarten, from the first day, after the first day, the second day, the third day, and so on. It is challenging because we want to offer grace and we want to give them a second chance and continue to remind them and help them. And I'm not only a teacher, but certainly I'm the mother as well of multiple children, and we want to help them. But at the same time, I know that if I train them with reminding them multiple times, they're going to rely on me reminding them multiple times. So I establish my expectations early on that I will let you know once, and it's more difficult initially because they really do want to please you, and sometimes they're going to forget, and certainly there's no large consequences, but we try to have it where the children need to be obedient from the first time they're given the instructions, because then they learn that we mean it right from the first time.
Do you want to talk about discipline or tally?
Yeah. Let me answer this question, and I think it'll dovetail into that one a little bit, because someone has asked to describe the behavior system we use in the classroom and what the consequences are, et cetera, and that'll feed into that. And another person asked about how we avoid standard behavior modification that most schools, public or private, use to get a desired behavior, and that's very important too. We use a tally system. I described this in my early workshop, so I'm sorry if you attended both. But there are seven categories of tallies. They go with the acronym How I Act. Hullabaloo is H. O is out of order. W is work not in. I is intentional disobedience. A is attitude. C is courtesy. T is talking. Now, the function of those categories is that as the students get infractions in these categories, we can see patterns. So say a child talks out of turn, they put up a talking tally. Now, there's no real consequence to that other than they get the tally, and they really don't want a tally. But the purpose of that is not a punishment, but it's a reminder. It's a record of transgression so that in time we can see patterns. Does this child have a problem with talking out loud? That's the area where they have to work on their self-control. Is it an attitude problem that keeps cropping up? Are they not turning their homework in the morning? This will help us to see these patterns. The teachers record the tallies we use RenWeb as our management system for the school. They will record the tallies in RenWeb in the behavior thing so the parents can see it as well. And then, so there's a record of it. If they get over a certain number in a week, depending on their grade, then they do come down and see me. It's an office visit so that I can help disciple them. And again, it's not behavior management here. This is discipling. And the main way to avoid behavior management is your attitude about what you're doing here and then how you speak to the children about it. It's true that their behavior makes your classroom go better, but the goal of discipling them is their hearts. It's repentance, it's to teach order, to teach self-discipline, and you've got to keep that as the goal when you're talking to the children about it. The appropriate response to discipline is repentance. That's what we're looking for. We're looking for repentance. We're looking for them to ask forgiveness. We're looking to restore them when they have that forgiveness, not to wallow in punishment. So the way you talk about it and these behaviors is that, and so we don't do little tricks and manipulations, and I think that's very important. When you manipulate a child's behavior, what you train up in that child is the vulnerability to be manipulated in the future. You've got a person now who will follow a manipulator, and you really don't want that. You want someone who has self-control, who respects authority, who is repentant when they've done wrong, who is quick to forgive, who is quick to accept forgiveness and to repent. So it's very important the way you look at that. So how you talk about it and how you talk about it to the student is very important. And administrators need to support their teachers in this, because a lot of that takes time that teachers don't necessarily have. So administrators need to come in and alongside the teachers with this and help with this, with the time it takes to discipline in that way. Behavior modification is fast. It's much faster. It doesn't benefit the child. Okay, so tally on the... Different teachers have different boards in their classrooms. They make their own. Some of them are felt boards where you put up a little felt tally, a different color based on which letter it is. Others have a dry erase kind of thing, and they use a dry erase marker. And back to your question about the first week of school is, we put the tallies up, but they don't go on the record. It's just, so we kind of call it amnesty week or whatever, but we help the kids to evaluate it without having it on the record, so it gives them practice time. But you don't want to say, okay, I'm not going to give you the tally this week. You'd rather say, we'll give it, but we won't keep a record of it. That way they practice getting the consequences along, because those consequences are to help them. So you don't want to deny them the help the first week. At the end of the week, they come down. Not the end of the day. Now, in kindergarten, our kindergarten has a modified, I almost feel like pulling Barbara up here, but in kindergarten, they have bears up on the clothesline, and they get their bear taken down instead of a tally. And then at the end of the day, it goes back up. Right here.
The first month of school, I give them, I had a very good day bear. That's so that the parent, because it's also new that it's overwhelming. And if you're expecting them to do something to keep up for a whole week, it can be very discouraging at this age. So we do it a little different. And so at the end of the day, they take home I had a very good bear. So that goes on for about 21 days. And then that forms pretty much a habit. They've learned what's expected in 21 days. And then we move to I had a very good week. Mm-hmm. And the bears go up in kindergarten every day, and that sort of keeps from the discouragement at that young age as well. Because they are learning a lot more self-control. First grade gets a little more controlled child.
So the first day you have some kids who do not go on the bear?
Probably. Absolutely, most of them. But I do prepare the parents for that. And I make sure, or we all do, we make sure that parents are prepared that it is a discipline, it's not a punishment. We want our children to learn from their mistakes, and this is discipling your children. It's a very different approach than you're a bad boy, you're a bad girl type thing. And it's hard on some of the parents. You have to do a little bit of educating there so that they understand that that you're training their children so that the good things that Barbara talked about can run wild. And if you don't spend this time, especially up front, it does produce chaos in your room instead of order.
I have two faster ones, the one that's a little bit more detailed. someone asked me a question about how do you use or what order do you use for lining up? Is there a specific order assigned? We do it in alphabetical order by last name, girls first. And with that said, my maiden name started with a Z. So on Wednesdays, we do reverse alphabetical order for all of those children, since I was at the last seat of the last row, my entire grammar, and I'm still have some pain from that. And then somebody asked me a question, but I think it goes to point. Do you let the children go to the bathroom anytime other than breaks? I do, but it's rare. And I'll tell you why. We take those regular breaks, and it is a training. It's a biological training. It's an obedience training. Well, obedience how? Is this a bathroom thing? It's a physiological thing. Well, sort of, but not completely. Everyone tries when we go to the bathroom. And typically, if we don't all try, we know because 10 minutes later they want to go. I'm a mom. I've been a teacher for a long time. I would imagine most of you are the same. And you know when there's a child that's having an emergency. And if a child's having an emergency, they absolutely can go. But I want them to know that the classroom is a precious time that we have. And if I keep having one or two coming in and out at all times, nothing's going to get accomplished.
You want me to do this, or do you want to take a question? Go ahead.
Okay, someone wants to hear the How I Act acronym again. H, hullabaloo. I'll go slowly. O, out of order. W, work not in or not done. Sometimes teachers will give that not just for homework that's not done and not turned in, but a child who wastes their time during classroom time and doesn't get done what they should have been able to do in 10 minutes, and it's now 40. I got it. Okay, I, intentional disobedience, and that's an office visit. That's not automatically an office visit. A is attitude. C is courtesy, and T is talking. Okay. This one is, do we ever allow sixth grade students to be a kindergarten helper for a scheduled time during the week or month? We do something similar to that. Our fifth grade students come down to kindergarten, what was it, once a week, Barbara? And they're reading buddies. And they pair off, they have their buddy assigned to them beginning of the year, and they stick together, that pair, and they sit on the floor with their books and they read together, and it is the most beautiful thing. It is, I really encourage you to do things like that, as any way you can get the older and the younger doing together. But they love their buddies, they end up special friends, and you can see them in the hall, you can tell when the fifth grade buddy and their kindergarten counterpart meet up in the hallway. It's a wonderful thing.
I've gotten multiple questions regarding early finishers and children that take a long time to complete their work. And I've certainly seen both, and I know you have as well. I'll deal with the easy one to start off with. The first one is the children that are taking a long time to complete their work. Well, it could be a behavioral issue or it could be something bigger than that. And I don't want to jump right into, as we were talking about, just a behavioral change, because that's easy to modify. The first thing as a teacher that I need to do is rule out if there is an issue. If they're in over their heads, if they don't really understand, if they're not reading well and it requires some reading, maybe there's a pride issue. Maybe they want their work to be absolutely so perfectly perfect that they're going to take absolutely the most amount of time that they can. That's going to take dialogue. That's certainly the one that's going to take the most amount of my time to understand and fix, if you will, or help correct. But it's time well spent. Once I've established that it isn't those things, that it's not a pride issue, it's not a perfectionist issue, it's not a lack of understanding, it's just kind of a child who wants to take their time. And I've had a couple in the past few years. My class sizes are usually less than 20, and so for example, in math, we have a math lesson. They come after I'm moving around, and my classroom aide is moving around and helping them to understand their work and make sure they're doing it correctly. That last check happens at my desk, and if you are among the first 10 people who bring your work to my desk and have it correct, because they might have to go back and continue to get it and make corrections, they get one of those little inexpensive stickers. Sometimes I'll use a stamp if I'm out of stickers. And I know as well as you do that they will do just about anything for a little tiny sticker, and that has become incredibly motivating. So I found when I start to fall into ruts of children who are taking a lot of time, maybe it's nearing the end of the school year or even the end of the week or the weather's starting to turn, a sticker does a behavioral trick as long as it's not a heart issue. And I encourage you to work those out and make sure that it's not, because that can be so much bigger. Early finishers, we have work at their desks at all times, work that's given out at the beginning of the week, projects that they're working on that might relate to other subject areas of science or geography. They always have reading books at their desk at whatever level that they're reading at. And I have two book boxes in the back of my classroom, one fiction, one nonfiction, that when they have completed their work, they can go back and get a book and bring it to their desk and be reading. But if I don't make sure they have enough work at their desk, I know that's where a lot of these questions are coming from, because the words used are, how do I keep them from being a distraction and being a distraction to the children around them? And I think giving them enough things to be working on throughout the week is important, not just a day, not just a worksheet, because you're not only teaching them geography and reading and math and science, you're also teaching them time management. You're teaching them how to be effective learners. You're teaching them how to use their time and to be courteous of those around them that are still getting their work.
Another approach to some of that, too, is the folder games. I talked about the centers, but folder games are another good one. No dice, right? Spinners. folder games can be effective review as well, so that it's productive time. So, we done them all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any more? Oh, a couple more.
A lot of it's in our curriculum. It could be add-ons. I'm sorry. We use, for example, Spell to Write to Read, and they've got some excellent add-ons at the bottom of their pages that are things that I'll have, okay, let's alphabetize the word list for this week. And those could be things that they're building on that need to happen sometime over the course of the week or the week prior. Could be any number of places.
Okay, I've got consequences of tallies. Again, our mindset is that tallies are not punishment, but they are a record. That record is then used as a discipleship tool for that child. If there are, and there's different levels for each grade, but I think it runs from 3 to 5, tallies during a week will result in a visit to my office. Again, that's not punishment. Is that better? Okay. That's not punishment. They've come down for me to sit with them and disciple them. We're going to go through the record. We're going to see what the problem is. We're going to work out a plan to correct the problem. If there are over 20 tallies, again, depending on the age, for the younger ones it's 35, I think. But anyway, there's a limit, a number of tallies that will then result in a parent meeting. And that's not in 1 week, of course. That's in a in the year. Pardon?
In 1 week, it's a
problem. In 1 week, it's a real serious problem. Probably week two won't happen. But but then we meet with the parents, and usually the parents, we'll meet with the parents first, and then we'll bring the child in, meet with the parent and the child. And again, we could discuss how this behavior's got to change. What are we going to do? What's the root of it? And try to change the behavior. The only punishments per se, I say we can do, and what we call an in-house suspension, which is rather than send them home for suspension so they can watch TV all day, we have them stay in school but isolated, and they do their work on their own. They eat their lunch on their own, no recess, and spend the day that way. 2 days, it's got to be 2 days. First day, it's like, I can take this. I can take the second day, drives them nuts. And they really are motivated at that point. We also have a social probation, which if it gets to the point where we're looking at the possibility of this student not being able to attend our school anymore, because it just hasn't improved, then we will have a social probation, and we actually do a contract with the parents and the student and with conditions. There will be no more of this behavior or no less than, And we don't usually use tallies for that, but that's usually because of a problem that's very serious, such as fighting on the playground, that kind of thing. And we'll say there will be no more incidents of this, or they will not have successfully completed their probation, and they will not be welcome to stay at Tall Oaks. So that punishment really isn't in that. We think it's that's the parent's duty. We do not live in a state. I know Matt talks about spanking. We do not live in a state where that would be. In fact, Delaware has practically outlawed parents spanking their children. So we're not in a place where we can do that. We do have a paddle that parents can use if they want to come in and use it. Mr. Post has it sitting in his on his bookshelf. So we expect the punishment to happen with the parents and not with us at school. It says, how do you feel about whole class rewards for a good week, 5 good days, etc.? The concern I have with that is if one student is holding back the whole class, and you know, these kids, some of them, they are struggling with these sin problems, most of them. It's not like they want to be the bad kid. And to hold the whole class back from the pizza party because they got too many tallies, I'm not sure that's the kind of pressure you'd want to do. I mean, you might want to surprise them sometime with something like that, but not make it directly linked to, if you do this many, then we will have a party. We do have in our system, we do award merits as well as tallies and demerits in the upper school. We have merits that are also recorded in RenWeb, and so when the child has done something especially nice or helpful or something, we will give them a merit, and often that's a way that you can encourage a kid who's been struggling, you know, the catch 'em being good kind of thing, and give them some encouragement for doing something well.
We use RenWeb, that's correct. Question I have is, how does the kindergarten or first grade teacher organize homework and to and from school folders, binders, newsletters? One of the requirements when you have your first grade supply list is to, and second grade handles it similarly, is they have one of those folders with the pockets, there's a number of different names for that. That is their homework folder. They might have similar folders for other subject matter, but they have one that is their homework folder and marked as such. That goes home every day and comes back every day. Their homework goes in there when it's handed out immediately into their homework folder, and that's brought back. I have them do it even if they don't have homework for that night. They take it home, they bring it back. Mom and Dad are looking for that. I send home, I give a spelling quiz almost every day, and they take that home. I grade it during the day, and they take that home so they can study for the next day's spelling quiz. So there's usually something going home. Work that's collected, like math homework, for example, or anything, we collect those during the week, and I keep them in folders, and then they go home in a clear packet every week for the students. So Fridays, they come home not only with their homework folder of things that need to be completed, but things, work that has been assessed, graded, as well as sometimes notifications of any number of things that the school might have that isn't necessarily only going out electronically, goes in that what we call clear packet. That gets sent home on a Friday, and they bring their clear packet back in empty, hopefully, on Monday morning.
Okay, quick one. What are folder games? I'm sorry. I didn't. A folder game, and you can buy books of them in teacher stores, such things. But you know, once you see some commercially made ones, you may want to make your own that tend more to our, you know, the curriculum we use in our schools. But basically, they are a game that goes in a manila folder. So the child brings the folder to their desk, opens it up, and inside are the game pieces they need and whatever task it is that needs to be done. It might be a matching task. It might be a writing task. There could be just instructions for some activity that they do. So if sometimes they're a board game. That's why I said about dice, because you don't want dice going when your other kids are still finishing up their work because of the noise and that falls on the floor and all that. So that was my that was explaining what that was. This is, if tallies are not disciplined, what to use for daily behavior, and why don't they keep them privately instead of humiliating the student. They are disciplined, they're not punishment. I'm distinguishing between discipline and punishment. Discipline is training. And biblical discipline doesn't really involve, it involves you, what you want, what your goal is for this child to repent. Your goal isn't for them to behave better for you. That's a fruit of repentance. But that's not the goal. The goal is repentance. And so as you handle little things in the classroom, not raising your hand, whatever, a tally is a reminder to that student. And often that's enough of a reminder to help them to develop self-control and repent of what they did and be able to get a handle on it. It's when there's patterns that aren't being responded to that you need to do the, you know, a higher level of discipline. Now, I'm not talking about punishment. I'm talking about bringing the child in, and often that's when I come in, or the teacher will talk to the child when there's a free time during recess or at lunch or something, and work them through a process of naming their sin, saying why it's a violation of God's law, leading them to ask forgiveness and to restore the child, and so that is discipline, but it's not punishment. If there needs to be punishment, then we have at our school the parents do that. Okay. And why don't we keep tallies privately instead of humiliating the student? The child has just sinned in front of the whole class, so the whole class knows it. So putting the tally up, and the rest of the class sees that behavior that they watched happen does get corrected. So there's no reason that if the whole class saw it, that the whole class can't know that you saw it too, and you responded to it. If something happens privately that the other kids don't know about, the tally usually doesn't go up on the board, but it does go in RenWeb. So if, for example, the teacher's in the back of the room and sees a child cheat on their test, they pull the child aside and deal with it, or they send them to my office and I deal with it, that will get written up in RenWeb, and parents will know about it, but it won't go up on the board.
Similarly, even if you're given a tally, it's not necessarily a very big whatever. It's not an attention getter necessarily. For example, if a child shouts out, I might say, okay, Jimmy, we don't shout out in class. Please go put up a tally. And then we continue right on in the lesson. It is not, and I can't, this is the 30th time this week, yet I can't, I'm going to call your mother. It's not that. It's a simple thing. It's a reminder that as Jimmy puts that up, oh, that's right, I really need to watch that behavior. But it also gives me as a teacher, because I'm keeping a notebook at my front desk, because I'm not running back to the computer every time that happens, that, oh, you know, sometimes I've got lists of students with what it is, because I'm not always remembering, or I'm making a quick note to log it in later. Because, especially as you get to parent-teacher conferences, or even if the behavior is repeating, I'm not going to remember what Jimmy's tallies were 2 weeks ago, let alone this morning, or what exactly the parameters of that behavior infraction were. But it's certainly not, it's not big. It only becomes bigger sometimes when you'll get to that sweet little girl who has not gotten a tally for the first several months of school. And then she gets that first tally because she, whatever it might be. And it becomes a big deal because I might say, okay, Susie, you need to go put up that tally for talking out of turn. And it becomes a tier event. But that's certainly something that we manage as well, because that's a life lesson. That is a spiritual lesson, not even a life lesson, that none of us is perfect, that we all need a Savior, that we all fall short, but yet we can still correct, turn back, and be redeemed.
It's a classroom board with each child's name on it in the section. Okay, our time is up. I'm getting the signal back in. Okay, yeah, it is a board with something for each child on it. You know, it might be apples. It might be, you know, they put their little worms on them or something, you know, something like that. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.